This assessment was echoed in a 1999 article in Health and Healing by Dr. Julian Whitaker, who stated, "Virtually all of the gun-related massacres that have made headlines over the past decade have had one thing in common. They were perpetrated by people taking Prozac, Zoloft, Luvox, Paxil, or a related antidepressant drug." In 1998, GlaxoSmithKline, maker of Paxil, was ordered to pay $6.4 million to surviving family members after Donald Schnell, 60, flew into a rage and killed his wife, daughter, and granddaughter just 48 hours after taking Paxil. The Teen Screen Truth site and the Indianapolis Star compiled a list of violent episodes dating as far back as 1985, when Stephen W. Brownlee, an Atlanta postal worker on psychotropic drugs, killed two co-workers. The list includes: in 1986, 14-year-old Rod Matthews of Canton, Massachusetts, beat a classmate to death with a baseball bat while on Ritalin. In 1988, 31-year-old Lori Dan, who had been taking anafrinil and lithium, walked into a second-grade classroom in Winnetka, Illinois, and began shooting. One child was killed and six wounded. Later that same year, 19-year-old James Wilson went on a shooting rampage at the Greenwood, South Carolina Elementary School and killed 2 8-year-old girls and wounded 7 others. He had been on Xanax, Valium, and 5 other drugs. In 1989, Patrick Purdy, 25, opened fire on a schoolyard filled with children in Stockton, California. 5 kids were killed and 30 wounded. He had been treated with Thorazine and amitriptyline. In 1993, Steve Leith of Chelsea, Michigan, walked into a school meeting and shot and killed the school superintendent, wounding 2 others, while on Prozac. In 1996, 10-year-old Tommy Becton grabbed his 3-year-old niece as a shield and aimed a shotgun at a sheriff's deputy who had accompanied a truant officer to his Florida home. He had been on Prozac. In 1997, Michael Carneal, 14, opened fire on students at a high school prayer meeting in Heath High in West Paducah, Kentucky. 3 died and 1 was paralyzed. Carneal reportedly was on Ritalin. In 1998, Kip Kinkle, a 15-year-old in Springfield, Oregon, murdered his parents and proceeded to his high school, where he went on a rampage, killing 2 students and wounding 22 others. Kinkle had been prescribed both Prozac and Ritalin. In 1998, 11-year-old Andrew Golden and 14-year-old Mitchell Johnson apparently faked a fire alarm at Westside Middle School in Jonesboro, Arkansas, and shot at students as they left the building. 4 students and a teacher were killed. The boys were said to be on Ritalin. In 1999, Sean Cooper, 15, of Notice, Idaho, took a shotgun to school and injured 1 student. He had been taking Ritalin. On April 20, 1999, Eric Harris, 18, and Dylan Klebold, 17, shot and killed 12 classmates and a teacher and wounded 24 others at Columbine High School in Colorado. Harris had been taking Luvox. In 1999, Todd Cameron Smith walked into a high school in Tabor, Alberta, Canada, with a rifle and killed 1 student and injured another. He had been given a drug after a 5-minute phone consultation with a psychiatrist. In 1999, Stephen Abrams drove his car into a preschool playground in Costa Mesa, California, killing 2. He was on probation with a requirement to take lithium. In 2000, T.J. Solomon, 15, opened fire at Heritage High School in Conyers, Georgia, while on a mix of antidepressants. 6 were wounded. The same year, Seth Trickey of Gibson, Oklahoma, 13, was on a variety of prescription drugs when he opened fire on his middle school class, injuring 5. In 2001, Elizabeth Bush, 14, was on Prozac. She shot and wounded another student at Bishop Newman High School in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Also in 2001, Jason Hoffman, 18, was on Effexor and Celexa, both antidepressants, when he wounded two teachers at California's Granite Hills High School. Same year, in Waluk, Washington, Corey Badsgaard, 16, took a rifle to his high school and held 23 classmates hostage. He had been taking Paxil and Effexor. In Osaka, Japan, also in 2001, Mamoru Takuma, 37, went into a second-grade classroom and started stabbing students. He killed 8. He had taken 10 times his normal dose of an antidepressant. In 2005, 16-year-old Native American Jeff Weiss on the Red Lake Indian Reservation in Minnesota was under the influence of the antidepressant Prozac when he shot and killed 9 people and wounded 5 before committing suicide. In 2006, Dwayne Morrison, 53, shot and killed a girl at Platte Canyon High School in Colorado. Antidepressants later were found in his vehicle. Other incidents cited, but not apparently related to schools, included: in 1987, William Cruz was charged with killing 6 people in Palm Bay, Florida, after taking psychiatric drugs for several years. The same year, Bartley James Dobbin killed his 2 young sons by throwing them into a 1,300-degree foundry ladle. He had been on a regimen of psychiatric drugs. In 1989, Joseph T. Westbecker, 47, just a month after he began taking Prozac, shot 20 workers at Standard Graver Corporation in Louisville, Kentucky, killing 9. Eli Lilly, which makes Prozac, later settled a lawsuit brought by survivors. In 1991, 61-year-old Barbara Mortensen was arrested by San Jose, California police, who said she had cannibalized her 87-year-old mother while on Prozac. In 1992, Linwood Drake III shot and killed 6 in San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay, California. Prozac and Valium were found in his system. In 1993, 16-year-old Victor Brancaccio attacked and killed an 81-year-old woman and covered her corpse with red spray paint. He was 2 months into a Zoloft regimen. In 1995, while on 4 medications, including Prozac, Dr. Deborah Green set her Prairie Village, Missouri home on fire, killing her children, ages 6 and 13. In 1996, Kurt Danish, 18, shot and killed his father 17 days after his first dose of Prozac. He told authorities, "I didn't realize I did it until after it was done. This might sound weird, but it felt like I had no control of what I was doing, like I was left there just holding a gun." It would appear that German drug science and German psychiatry have provided the foundation for action toward today's schoolchildren who are being increasingly steered to drugs for any complaint, from true antisocial behavior to mere daydreaming. And why hasn't the watchdog media put these stories together and presented it to the public? Direct-to-consumer pharmaceutical advertising grew from $791 million in 1996 to more than $3.8 billion by 2004. Those familiar with this subject claim media executives fear the loss of advertising revenues from the giant pharmaceutical corporations, some of the largest advertisers in the nation. Why haven't physicians spoken out about this? Many have, but they don't receive significant coverage in the corporate mass media, and many more fear reprisals from both the drug corporations and the federal government. Additionally, corporate drugs are heavily promoted to physicians. The pharmaceutical companies send representatives to physicians' offices talking about their drugs, giving free samples of their drugs, those types of things. That effort dwarfs the pharmaceutical corporation's advertising expenditures, explained Alan Matthios, a dean at the College of Human Ecology at Cornell University. But the education issue that has drawn the greatest recent controversy is Public Law 107-110, known better as the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001, NCLB, a prized legacy of the Bush administration. According to the Act, its purpose is to ensure that all children have a fair, equal, and significant opportunity to obtain a high-quality education and reach, at a minimum, proficiency on challenging state academic achievement standards and state academic assessments. Signed into law by President George W. Bush on January 8, 2002, the Act nevertheless brought immediate criticism from educators, state authorities, and libertarians alike. They questioned the Act's sweeping proposals, which range from forcing teachers to confirm the federally mandated curricula to inflicting monetary punishments on school districts that do not live up to federal expectation, and even taking state control or turning them over to private management companies. They also questioned the $410 million apportioned for the education of migratory children, most of whom come from the families of illegal aliens. Standardized testing has proven a handicap to children who speak English as a second language. While no caring person would want to be caught leaving some poor child behind, there was nevertheless the irksome feeling by many that the Act was a thinly disguised attempt to force conformity on students and standardize the minds of American youth. It smacks of the same uniformity of education sought by the National Socialists under Hitler. Some conservatives and libertarians even claim that the Act is an usurpation of state authority by the federal government. In 2007, the new Congress began taking steps to protect states from the controls and punishments of NCLB. For example, in 2005, when Utah passed a state law allowing school districts to ignore portions of NCLB, the Department of Education threatened to withhold federal education funds. The backbone of NCLB is federally mandated standardized testing, which long has been accused of cultural bias. In fact, the entire practice of testing as a determinant of educational quality has been called into question because the emphasis on tests forces teachers to teach only material that will get students to pass the tests, leaving a deficiency in grasping greater understanding and thinking critically. It should also be realized that both the textbook publishers and the standardized testing firms are, for the most part, controlled by the same globalist corporations under discussion. The Act rewards districts with better test scores, so critics can't claim that schools lower their standards to show improvement on test scores. The kids are not learning more, just being assessed differently. A 2007 report from the Center on Education Policy, CEP, indicated increased test scores in reading and math, but it was unclear if this reflected enhanced learning or lower standards on student tests. Look at any state that has a 90% proficiency level with lots of students in poverty, commented Jack Jennings, president and CEO of CEP. That doesn't happen without either an extraordinary effort to raise the quality of education for all students or setting lower standards. Another portion of the NCLB Act that rankled libertarians was Section 9528, which requires schools to give military recruiters the name, home phone number, and address of every enrolled student. Schools are not required to tell the students or parents that their information has been passed on, but students can ask to not have their contact information shared. But filing the required form often means student information is withheld from universities and job recruiters, as well as the military. Unlike the Nazis, who placed great emphasis on athletics and physical fitness, the NCLB Act narrowly focuses on two main skills, reading and math. As a result, there are claims that other areas of schooling have been neglected, especially physical education. This idea was reinforced by recent data from the Centers for Disease Control, showing kids between the ages of 6 and 19, some 9 million youngsters, suffer from obesity. With the obesity rates going up, and it's in our face, why are we cutting PE time? I don't get it, questioned PE teacher Garrett Liddick, Delaware's 2006 Teacher of the Year. The focus right now is on testing, he said, referring to a series of academic tests now mandated by federal law. The result is that there's less time to get kids more active. It's a stretch even to call the law well-intentioned, given that its creators, including the Bush administration and the right-wing Heritage Foundation, Paul Weyrich, its founder, has been accused of ties to Nazi collaborators, want to privatize public education. Hence, NCLB's merciless testing, absurd timetables, and reliance on threats, commented USA Today education writer Alfie Cohn. No wonder 129 education and civil rights organizations have endorsed a letter to Congress deploring the law's overemphasis on standardized testing and punitive sanctions. No wonder 30,000 people, mid-2007, have signed a petition at educatorroundtable.org, calling the law too destructive to salvage. Like Hitler, the globalist creators of a new empire carry an innate distrust of education that might explain why their education programs appear to savage true learning. I do not wish any intellectual upbringing whatsoever. Knowledge may only demoralize youth, Adolf Hitler once said. He echoed the statement of John D. Rockefeller, founder of the National Education Board, who said, "I don't want a nation of thinkers. I want a nation of workers." Hitler also felt intellectuals might not only present a rival to Nazi ideology, but could form a group separate from the common man through a feeling of superiority due to their knowledge and education. "What we suffer from today is an excess of education," he stated in 1938. "What we require is instinct and will." Hitler's sentiment was echoed recently by President George W. Bush. Journalist Ron Suskind, writing in the New York Times Magazine, reported an incident in Washington. 40 Democratic senators were gathered for a lunch in March 2004, just off the Senate floor. I was there as a guest speaker. Joe Biden was telling a story about the president. "I was in the Oval Office a few months after we swept into Baghdad," he began, "and I was telling the president of my many concerns." Bush, Biden recalled, just looked at him, unflappably sure that the United States was on the right course and that all was well. "Mr. President," I finally said, "how can you be so sure when you know you don't know the facts?" Biden said that Bush stood up and put his hand on the senator's shoulder. "My instincts," he said. "My instincts." The Fourth Reich in America, it seems, is guided by instincts, just as during Hitler's Reich. One major difference between the Third Reich and the Fourth Reich is the lack of emphasis on flag ceremonies and repetitious pledges. In Nazi Germany, a school day did not pass without these ceremonies of the state. But in multicultural and globalized America, although school children still recite the Pledge of Allegiance and raise the U.S. flag, any formal ceremony has dropped away. Today, hardly any American, child or adult, with the possible exception of some Girl and Boy Scouts, knows or observes proper flag protocols. If the Pledge of Allegiance is used in schools, it is generally spoken over the loudspeaker. Students can recite along or not, as they will. If they can obtain a note from their parents, they are not even required to stand. Patriotic allegiance to one's nation is not conducive to the globalists' agenda of borderless countries under the control of multinational corporations. Today, such nationalistic trappings have been replaced by ubiquitous corporate logos and slogans. More and more educational programs are being underwritten and guided by corporate officials. President Bush's Secretary of Education, Margaret Spellings, hosted the 2006-2007 Siemens Competition in Math, Science, and Technology. In May 2006, she told attendees of the first national summit on the advancement of girls in math and science in Washington, D.C., "I recently met with George Nolan, President and CEO of Siemens Corporation, and I look forward to working with him on President Bush's American Competitiveness Initiative." Business leaders began to recognize that education had failed to keep up with the corporatism of America. Prudential CEO Art Ryan complained that hiring high school graduates today is a high risk. They can't do many of the things you would like them to do. But have high schools changed to reflect that economy? I would argue, not enough. Another rising concern in education that can be traced back to corporate intrusion is the rise of advertising in schools. According to a debate posted on the official NEA website, teachers have complained that getting kids to buy products, feel good about a corporation, or adopt the viewpoints of an industry on an important issue is not the purpose of education, and that promotional sponsored education materials blur the line between education and propaganda and lead to distorted lessons. Manny Lopez, a fourth grade teacher at the International Community School in Oakland, California, warned, "Upon entering our schools, advertisers would dictate the placement of their billboards, banners, and light boxes. The highly visible areas normally reserved for students' artwork, bulletin boards, and school community message centers would be taken over. It would only be a matter of time before advertisers would attempt to have a hand in the curriculum, molding a school into a corporate image." Retired Georgia teacher Elizabeth Gould wrote, "Advertising gives students a warped sense of the world. They think everything is up for sale, ethics, morals, children." Arguing in favor of school advertising, Kathleen McMahon, a fourth grade teacher at Alice Costello School in Brooklawn, New Jersey, said, "In an ideal world, schools would have all the money they need to fund programs and buy equipment. But we're not living in utopia. Public and private colleges accept money from plutocrats every day." Gary Ruskin, writing in Advertising Age magazine, urged advertisers to exercise self-restraint or face future legal restrictions. He noted, "Advertisers are being expelled from schools in droves. Channel One, the in-school advertising service, was removed last school year from Nashville and will soon be kicked out of Seattle. New restrictions on the marketing or sale of soda or junk food in school have been approved in places such as California, Texas, New York City, and Philadelphia." Corporate involvement with education is not a new idea. In the late 1800s, a group of Chicago businessmen became concerned that education in Germany and Austria was moving ahead of American education. Unlike American schools, German classrooms divided kids into two tracks, one for those destined to become managers and the other for those destined to be their employees, explained Elizabeth Weiss Green, writing in U.S. News and World Report. But even in the 1800s, thoughtful persons questioned the propriety of business guiding education. Education would then become an instrument of perpetuating unchanged the existing industrial order of society. Who, then, shall conduct education so that humanity may improve? Questioned John Dewey, the American philosopher, psychologist, and education reformer. In mid-2007, billionaires Bill Gates and Eli Broad announced they had pooled $60 million to finance a campaign to emphasize education in the 2008 elections. However, the pair's ideas for improving American education were immediately criticized because the three tenets of their campaign were making teachers' salary increases dependent on student test scores, keeping students in class with more days and longer hours, and setting federal curriculum standards based on input from corporate leaders. National Socialism in the Germany of the 1930s made a strong appeal to its youth. The Nazis fully realized that if the younger generations could be brought to their worldview, the future of National Socialism would be assured. Fascism in all countries made a fetish of youthfulness, commented George L. Moss, author of Nazi Culture. What a contrast this offered to the elderly politicians haggling in parliaments, or to the fossilized bureaucrats which ran the nations and the political parties of Europe. Modern America also has witnessed conflict between the younger and older generations. The genesis of this generational conflict began with the rock and roll music of the 1950s and grew full-blown with the Vietnam War, when families were split along lines of age. The young embraced the anti-war movement, while the older generations, tempered by the propaganda of World War II, supported the war policies of Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon. Here again was a reflection of Nazi Germany, where Hitler's promises of a more prosperous future held considerable sway with the younger generations. "The young were set off against the old," observed Moss, "and the distinction that was made between the old and young nations was operative within the Volk itself. When Hitler damned the bourgeoisie, he was inveighing against the older generation, brought up under the First and Second Empire. This generational conflict caused by control over popular culture such as music, films, art, etc., was merely another use of the divide-and-conquer tactic." American journalist and educator Milton Mayer was both Jewish and of German ancestry. He traveled in Europe before the war and tried, unsuccessfully, to gain an audience with Hitler in 1935. 7 years after the war ended, Mayer traveled in Germany, searching to understand what had made the average German blindly follow National Socialism. "I never found the average German," he recounted in a 1955 book, "because there is no average German. But I found 10 Germans sufficiently different from one another in background, character, intellect, and temperament to represent among them some millions or tens of millions of Germans and sufficiently like unto one another to have been Nazis. I found, and find, it hard to judge my Nazi friends," he wrote. "I liked them. I couldn't help it. I was overcome by the same sensation that had got in the way of my newspaper reporting in Chicago years before. I liked Al Capone. I liked the way he treated his mother. He treated her better than I treated mine." Mayer recounted the story of one unnamed German academic, a language teacher, and his experience as Hitler's Third Reich grew in prominence. In light of modern America, it is worth repeating. This teacher said that after 1933, no one seemed to notice the ever-widening gap between the government and the people. The separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure or associated with true patriotic allegiance or with real social purposes. And all the crises and reforms, real reforms too, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter. As a scholar, this man was consumed with meetings, conferences, interviews, ceremonies, and above all, papers to be filled out, reports, bibliographies, lists, questionnaires. It was rigmarole, of course, but it consumed all one's energies, coming on top of the work one really wanted to do. You can see how easy it was then not to think about fundamental things. One had no time. The dictatorship and the whole process of its coming into being was above all diverting. It provided an excuse not to think for people who did not want to think anyway. Unconsciously, I suppose, we were grateful. Who wants to think? He said to live in this process required not noticing it. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained or, on occasion, regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures that no patriotic German could resent must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. One day, it is over his head. Pastor Martin Niemöller spoke for men like this academic when he said, "First, they came for the communists, but I was not a communist, so I did not speak out. Then they came for the socialists and the trade unionists, but I was neither, so I did not speak out. Then they came for the Jews, but I was not a Jew, so I did not speak out. And when they came for me, there was no one left to speak out for me." A great part of this hesitancy to resist encroaching fascism was not due to fear, according to the academic Milton Mayer, but to genuine uncertainty that anyone else was seeing the things as he did. In Nazi Germany, people who questioned the motives behind government policies were deemed alarmists. In America today, they are called conspiracy theorists. In small gatherings of your oldest friends, you feel that you are talking to yourselves, that you are isolated from the reality of things. This weakens your confidence still further and serves as a further deterrent. It is clearer all the time that if you are going to do anything, you must make an occasion to do it, and then you are obviously a troublemaker. So you wait, and you wait, explained an unnamed teacher quoted by Mayer. But the one great shocking occasion when tens or hundreds or thousands will join with you never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and smallest, thousands, yes, millions, would have been sufficiently shocked. But of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. He said that the person who is aware suddenly sees the whole world in a new way. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were born in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring, the houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear, and the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Suddenly it all comes down, all at once. You see what you are, what you have done, or more accurately, what you haven't done, for that was all that was required of most of us, that we do nothing. And the people in Germany who, once the war had begun, still thought of complaining, protesting, resisting, were betting on Germany's losing the war. It was a long bet. Not many made it.